Good afternoon. Welcome to Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross at 5:06. Final program for September of 2012. Coming up on today's extravaganza, we'll meet John Wright of the folk duo Leto and Wright. They're going to be on the stage of the Mabel Tainter in Menominee soon. We're going to talk with Ivar Lundy Jr. about tomorrow's Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra concert. Jim Oliver welcomes Mike Cook, and they'll reprise Thoroughly Modern Millie. And a museum honors American Indian heritage. We'll welcome one of the presenters, Dr. Larry Martin. Let's begin. Tomorrow evening marks the start of the 13th season of the Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra. The first event is called Mostly Baroque, and rather than take for granted that all of us know exactly what Baroque is, I thought we should probably ask the maestro himself, Ivar Lundy Jr., Echo Music Director. So, Baroque, as it pertains to music, is it all about the same period in history? Is it about certain characteristics of the music? Is it about how it's written? One of those? All of those?
Yes. Yes to all, because it's a sign of the times. The Baroque art, as you know, is very ornamental. The music is very ornamental. Basically simple melodies sometimes dressed up with a lot of ornamentation. You look at the architecture and you look at the way people even dressed, you know, the frilly stuff. So that's the way the music is, and that's what we're trying to replicate more or less.
And you mentioned the vocal parts.
Well, the early orchestra ended up being a support group for vocal choral music and so forth. And even in Handel Messiah, for instance, all the orchestral parts, certainly the wind parts, will support the vocal lines and the choruses. When you talk about the orchestra, for instance, what we are doing for the most part this Saturday is to take the four different vocal parts with soprano, alto, and tenor and bass, and that will be divided into like first and second violin and the basses, and the tenor part is sometimes the viola, and then you add some of the winds for color and so forth. And in the first piece that we are doing on Saturday will be with a featured solo violinist and two flute players, and they actually play recorder parts, but we do it in modern instruments. And then you have a string orchestra as a background. The second piece is a classical work. We don't really know for sure who wrote the piece, but we think it is Franz Joseph Haydn. That's scored for very meager wind parts, two horns and two oboes and a bassoon. Actually, the bassoon is not really mentioned in the score, but it's natural when you have wind parts in a group like that to have a bassoon to play the bass part, to augment the bass part. And the rest will be strings, and they have two solo horns. That's it. So it's a very small orchestration. And that's typical of the Baroque as well as the classical periods. We're talking about the size of the orchestra. And the last piece will be for strings only with a vocal soloist. And we have two instrumental soloists as well from the orchestra. One is a flute player, one's a clarinet player. And the clarinet part is kind of a unique part because normally you don't find a clarinet in the so-called sophisticated classical orchestra at the time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's more of a shepherd's instrument.
You're featuring the music of three composers. Are any of those three considered the father of Baroque music?
They are the high point of Baroque music,
yeah.
Yes.
Who's credited with beginning that?
Well, it starts in the Renaissance, and it moves from there. I mean, it's hard to say who does what. In the terms of the Concerto Grosso, I think Arcangelo Corelli is probably very, very instrumental in that. But that's early Baroque period. Transition is probably a result of many, many, many geniuses.
There isn't one piece out there that is credited with being the first Baroque hit.
No, I don't think so. Even when you go into the classical period, you can hear in Mozart how he emulates the sons of Bach, for instance, various other composers as well. And one of his mentors in Salzburg, Michael Haydn, that's the brother of Joseph Haydn. Michael and Wolfgang worked together, even though they were years and years apart. They collaborated on a lot of things. And if you listen to Michael Haydn's works, you can hear some of Mozart in there too. Or should I say that you can hear some of Michael Haydn's in the Mozart's works. Mozart himself even asked when he moved to Vienna to have scores by Michael Haydn sent to him in Vienna so he could study them. Although it's probably true that Mozart was, even at his age at that time, a better composer, but he was a learning person at that time, so he learned from a lot of people.
Are there any contemporary composers who are well known for penning in a Baroque style?
No, I don't think so. There are neo-Baroque composers. I mean, you have even people like Stravinsky and Respighi and so forth. They have kind of borrowed from the past, and they do it in the style of. I have done some of that. And the next concert will feature Jerry Edinger's Symphony No. 12, which is in the style of Mozart. So people do that, but that's more in the commercial market, I think. You know, when you have a commercial on TV, for instance, you have background music, and some people write a neo piece of sorts, you know, to go with that.
Saturday's concert features Bach, Haydn, and Vivaldi. Yeah. Well, you know, in this day and age, we like to compare things, and competition is cool. If there was a popularity contest, which one of those three would win?
Well, if you think of it this way, Bach borrowed from Vivaldi and transcribed some of Vivaldi's works. So that meant that Bach has high regard for Vivaldi.
There was no vice versa there?
No, I think.
Different periods?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, it's just basically the same.
They were contemporaries?
Yes, very much so. Then you have Haydn. Well, as I said, you know, we don't really know for sure if Franz Joseph was the composer of this. Some people think it was an Italian composer, as a matter of fact, unknown. It's not as sophisticated, perhaps, as some of the Haydn works. But a lot of Haydn's compositions ended up being attributed to other people, too, and vice versa. So if you think of anyone learning from anyone else, Haydn learned from Bach and Vivaldi.
Any one of the three more a prolific writer than the other two? Who's well known for having the most works?
I don't think I can tell you that.
No.
Because some of these works did not survive. There are tons of music, apparently, by Bach, written when he was in his first three jobs that we don't really have much evidence of. Haydn wrote 104 some symphonies. Lots of other choral works and whatnot. Vivaldi, as I was writing the program notes, is more or less recognized as the composer of 50 operas or 50-some operas, but he himself claimed to have written 94 operas, tons of chamber music, for winds, for strings, lots and lots and lots. So, and who knows, some of this is probably already lost.
Well, it's your 15th season. That's a milestone. Does it feel like 15 years?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes not. When I go to the rehearsal and we start working, it's like starting over again. And sometimes we have new faces. We only have, I think for this Saturday, we have four or five, actually, with myself and my wife, who started in the orchestra. The rest of the people are new people.
Oh.
So you have new faces, and with new faces come new challenges. It's quite exciting, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing some really interesting compositions, certainly the ones by Vivaldi. My wife and I had to go to microfilms to find the parts written, because all we had from the soloist was a piano reduction, and piano reductions are not the originals. And I actually did make an orchestral arrangement out of those, but I couldn't use them. So we had to go to various libraries to find the originals, and that was quite interesting.
Speaking of quite interesting, you and I haven't chatted since the chamber orchestra played at Phoenix Park. Your concert Saturday is at First Lutheran Church. That's the comfortable confines where you're usually found. How was the experiment? Yeah, we have to do more of that, or never again.
Well, to tell you the truth, the board, those are the people who provide the funding and everything else, since this is basically for us and a huge expense, they always, like any business, will make an evaluation of what happened. So we had a big discussion, and I think the consensus was that this was a very good thing, very good thing. So if we had the money, we'd probably do more of this kind, because it's free for the audience. Sure. It's not free for us. We had to pay people, and some people come from far away. So.
Well, it was a good evening. Some of the notes didn't get heard by all the ears, but
that's
it was...
Yes, that's true. That's because we. This was a first for them, and it certainly was a first for many of us. Mm-hmm. I have done these kinds of things before other places. So I was not surprised when people were running around in the background there and people talking and shouting and walking about. But by and large, I think they were quite interested. And I was very, very, very pleased when you asked the audience if they knew of us. And quite a few people said they did.
I would think that Owen Park would be a wonderful place to play with the band shell and...
No, I think that would be the only reason why we don't do summer concerts will be because of the funding.
We have to put together a plan and we get a bank account going to get the chamber orchestra at Owen Park. Yes. You have the seating.
Of course, they have the band program there every Thursday right. night. We played at Phoenix Park on Thursday night, so there's some sort of a competition.
Well, an afternoon would work.
We have problems in that we have people from out of town.
A weekend afternoon.
Weekend, possibly, yes. A Sunday afternoon would actually be quite nice if we had no ball games and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know. Was I the antagonist or protagonist in that exchange? Whatever. Sounds like a neat idea, and where there's a will, there's a way. Thanks to Ivar Lundy Jr. for taking time out of his busy studio schedule to help us take a look at tomorrow's concert and more. By the way, it's at First Lutheran Church on Oxford Avenue in Eau Claire. Tickets available at the door. The website is Eau Claire Chamber Orchestra, one long word, .org.
Support for WPR comes from the Eau Claire Community Foundation, now accepting applications for Women's Giving Circle grants for programs benefiting women and children. More information and grant application forms are available at eccommunityfoundation.org.
Spectrum West on a Friday, the 28th of September. Thanks so much for being with us. Remember the Big Band Extravaganza at UW Eau Claire tomorrow evening, Gantner Concert Hall. Watch the battle between Jazz Ensembles 1 and 2, and a lot more. The Chenille Sisters perform this evening, 7:30, in the Ladysmith High School Auditorium, part of the Flambeau Valley Arts Association 41st season. Season tickets on sale at flambeauvalley.com/FVAA. Time now to welcome our weekly and awaited contribution from Mr. Jim Oliver, who travels western Wisconsin in search of what's happening in regional theater. And it's nice to know, thanks to all the fine and active theater companies, he does not have to search very long.
Thoroughly Modern Millie, a musical based on a 1967 film by the same name, will open Thursday and run through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production is directed by Mike Cook, who is here to talk about the show. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
Well, the show is set in 1922, so I expect we can see a lot of roaring 20s-style flapper music and dancing and all of that stuff.
That's pretty much the way it goes with this. The idea behind the show is Millie, who's a small-town girl, gets all the big ideas from everything that's happened in the early 20s. You know, the women had just gotten the right to vote, and things were changing in America. The mores were changing, and women were becoming more independent, and she gets the idea in her head that it would be a good idea to go to New York, get a job, find a rich boss, marry him, retire, and call it good. So complications ensue because it doesn't work out exactly like she thinks it's going to work out.
So who are some of the principal actors in the show?
Well, Carrie Herman Baggs plays Millie. She's quite a talented girl. Millie's a very big part. It's called Thoroughly Modern Millie for a reason. And her friend Miss Dorothy is played by Carly Preisner. Some of the men in the cast include Trevor Graydon, who's played by Jeff McLean. Jimmy, whose last name is kind of up for grabs, is played by Chase Allen. Very talented actors and singers.
Mm-hmm. So you have musical directors, choreographers, all that stuff.
I have all of that, yes.
So who are they?
Well, our musical director is Aurora Krenikandi. I always have problems mentioning her name.
I have spoken to her a number of times in the same difficulty, yes.
Beautiful girl. Mm-hmm. She's a great, great music teacher, and I'm blessed having her as vocal instructor and vocal coach for the show. Adam Bowl, who's the band director at Mondovi High School, is our orchestra conductor. Choreographers are Josh Hamas Murray, who's been kicking around the dance scene in Eau Claire for a long, long time. His sister Sarah, who has been doing the same, is his assistant. And we also have Carol Kelm from Glenwood City, who comes over from time to time and has taken a few dances under her wing and is doing a good job with those.
How about building the set and all that kind of thing?
Oh, we've got Bob Sessions on set crew.
Oh, him, yes.
Bob builds all the sets all the time, and there can't be a better guy doing it. So I'm pleased that he's doing it, and that means, for me, less work because I can trust him with everything.
Is this a pretty elaborate set?
It's not really an elaborate set. Now, Broadway, when they did it, they had this big revolve. They spent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably millions of dollars on what they did. It's not necessary to do that, and since we don't have that kind of money anyway, we had to pare it down a little bit. So the sets are somewhat minimal, but it's okay. And even in the script that came from the script company said that you don't have to go elaborate with it. You can tone it down a little bit. So by necessity we did, but it doesn't hurt the show at all. Mm-hmm. As long as you can suggest a location or people understand what you're doing and where you are in the play, then it's really not necessary to have, you know, gigantic houses that rotate or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, why don't you talk about some of the music in the play?
The music is classic 20s style music. I'm talking about Charleston style numbers. There's a lot of tap dancing type music in here. Beautiful ballads, unbelievably beautiful ballads. They won the Tony Award for the best score. And there's a couple of famous songs in the show that were songs that they pulled in from the history of the 1920s. For example, Mammy. The Al Jolson song is sung in the show, but as a twist, it's sung in Chinese. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Oh, okay. That raises all sorts of issues about language and all that kind of thing. Well, anyway, so he is Mike Cook, who is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Thoroughly Modern Millie. You are well known in local theater as a director and actor at the Theater Guild and other places. Including Fanny Hill, of course. You are to be found in internet film sites as a movie actor.
Well, that's what they tell me, yes.
Anyway, most recently you were featured in House of Ghosts, which had a screening at the Grand Little Theater in Eau Claire as a fundraiser. Tell us about that experience in that show.
Well, House of Ghosts is the brainchild of Christopher Mim out of Minneapolis, who has been for the last, 8 or 9 years, been putting out a classic 1950s-style creature feature, black and white, the cheesy things. He's been doing one a year for the last several years, and I've been lucky enough to be involved in a number of those films. Basically, he makes them because they don't make them anymore. They stopped making them in the 50s, well, usually for a good reason, but like he said, he's seen every single one of those movies from the 50s, so he thought, why not make some new ones? So we've been doing that and having a lot of success in film festivals across the United States and around the world. They've been playing in Australia and other foreign countries. They've been dubbed into Esperanto, of all languages.
Where do you speak Esperanto?
There are Esperanto clubs everywhere, much to the surprise of everyone who doesn't speak Esperanto, apparently. And they've played in Esperanto film festivals. Yes, they have those, too, all over the world. I think the last one I heard of was in Sweden. It's an eclectic audience that we have, both in English and in Esperanto, but it's a very rewarding experience, and it's a lot of fun. We like to call them new, old, good, bad movies.
Uh-huh. Now, I read somewhere that this was his first ghost story. Is that true?
It was his first ghost story. We've been doing, like, the classic nuclear fallout causes a large animal to mutate-type movies. We've been doing that sort of thing over the years. There have been a couple of space epics that he's done, science fiction-wise, but this was the first actual ghost story that he tried, and it was based on the works of William Castle, who back in the 1960s was the master of gimmicks, horror movie gimmicks. For example, he would wire seats with like those hand buzzers, those novelty buzzers, and when shock would come on screen, they'd have the theater hit a button, and everybody would, you know, be shocked out of their seats and things like that. So we came up with a few gimmicks for this film as well.
Now, is this mainly shown in arts theaters or special programs?
Well, yes, they're played usually in special events or film festivals, and he likes to show them at science fiction conventions and horror conventions. He goes around the country doing it that way. Mm-hmm. You can also order the movies if you want to buy one at his website, which is SaintEuphoria.com. Okay. So it can be seen any number of ways.
And you can also Google House of Ghosts, I discovered.
Oh, yes. So, oh, yes, you can.
So that's the simplest way to remember that, I think. I also found that you were in two other films scheduled for release next year. So tell us about those.
Well, the next one in the Christopher Mims series is called The Giant Spider, and I think that kind of explains itself. It's another one of those nuclear fallout hits the spiders thing. And
you're not in the title role.
No, I'm not in the title. I have to talk to him about that. But,
sorry.
That's okay. I play one of the scientists who's trying to figure it out. So that'll be coming out about a year from now. Mm-hmm. And the next one is called Ain't Life Grand, and it was filmed through the University of Minnesota through their communications department, and it's the story about a low-power television station that's going off the air due to lack of funds and the problems that it causes in the lives of the people who work there.
Where does he produce his films? Does he have studios of his own, or does he find places to go, or what?
Mr. Mim?
Yeah.
He usually films in Minneapolis in various locations, and mm-hmm. that's where he lives, and he likes to keep it there. Mm-hmm. He's not a fan of going out to Hollywood or anything like that, or New York. He figures that there are many talented people in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and he taps that talent base, and it's a lot of talent out there.
That was going to be my next thought, I guess, was that there are a lot of theaters in the Twin Cities area, in addition to Western Wisconsin, as we've discovered, mm-hmm. and so I'm assuming that's probably where he draws his talent.
Absolutely.
Well, he is Mike Cook. He is director of the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Thoroughly Modern Millie, also a film actor we've been discussing. The show runs Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For tickets, call the Theater Guild at 715-832-PLAY. Mike Cook, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Ken Vance Hyundai, featuring the new 2013 Hyundai Elantra, now equipped with a 1.8-liter engine and 6-speed transmission with Shifttronic and active ecosystem for fuel economy. More at kenvance.com.
Another stellar report from Jim Oliver. Thank you. Coming up on 529 here on Spectrum West. A Spectrum memo. A reception this evening marks the opening of an exhibit of stained glass art. And then tomorrow evening, it's Secrets from the Wings, as Lemoyne McLaughlin reads from his most recent book of poems, all at the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts. And that, of course, is in Amory. Dr. Lawrence Martin, who'd rather be called Larry, so we'll do that from now on, is the Director Emeritus of the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Next Saturday, October 6th, the Chippewa Valley Museum welcomes Dr. Martin as one of the presenters during American Indian Heritage Community Day. The UWEC Studies Program began in 1976 when Vita Stone, a blue-gold faculty member at the time, instituted the program, and it only offered a minor in American Indian Studies at that time. Dr. Martin now continues on that thought.
In about 96 or 97, they instituted a major in American Indian Studies, and at that point, I think, got authorization to have a full-time director. And I was teaching, I'm from up around here, but I was teaching in Ohio at the time, and I always kind of wanted to get back here. Mm-hmm. And also, I wanted to be able to do more in Indian Studies than I was doing out there. I was doing some there, but I wanted more to get more centrally located in an Indian Studies program. So I applied. So I came here in, I think it was the fall of 98, and the major was just kind of getting started. And then I retired in 2008. So I was director of the program for 10 years.
Obviously, people can do what you have done with it, but what kinds of other things can a person do with a major in American Indian Studies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one thing we always hoped American Indian students would major in Indian Studies and go back to their reservations and, you know, become leaders in tribal government and things like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe someday we'll really achieve that. I think so far we don't have any tribal chairmen who are graduates that I know of. Some people have gone back and worked in tribal historic preservation offices and that kind of thing. We had, for a while, we had an interesting program training along with the education school at UW-Eau Claire, training a group of American Indian elementary school teachers. Mm-hmm. That was a good thing, I think. A lot of our students are non-Indian, and they've done a lot of different kind of things. I mean, a lot of them have gone on to graduate school. Quite a few have. Not too many have gone to work for tribes, which kind of surprised us. I think I always encourage people to, when I was a director, I should say, I always encourage people to do double majors and to try to choose a second major that would be something that would be very practical for the tribes, like accounting or nursing or something like that. Some of those aren't realistic, I suppose, like social work, for example. You can't really minor in, or double major in social work. I mean, it's a huge program, and you know, but some people have, in fact, done that. So it probably took them an extra year. Which is a good thing.
The American Indian Studies program includes things like, you brought up anthropology already, art history, education, English, geography, history, sociology. You were listed as having taught philosophy and religious studies.
So, sometime before I retired, there was a fellow in the religious studies program who had a course called Indigenous Religions of the Americas. And then he left here and wasn't replaced with somebody who had that particular expertise. And I decided to sort of take it up. So I started teaching that course shortly before I retired. And actually, that's the one I'm still teaching. Even though I'm retired, I wanted to keep my foot in a little bit, especially with a course that wouldn't be offered every semester, and this one isn't.
Tell me a little bit about religion as it plays into the life of a Native American. Well, is it so varied that it's tough to get into?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, every tribe has its own religious traditions, of course.
I guess the religion practiced by the oldest of Americans is something that maybe a lot of us don't understand. Is it so different from the religion that most of us have, the Lutherans and the Catholics and the so-and-sos?
Well, boy, these are huge questions, you know, Alan.
Yeah, well.
In some ways, it's very different. I think you know, people often speak of the Great Spirit, which is, I think, a kind of translation of the Ojibwe, Gijimanadu, or I guess the Lakota Wakantanka, which means more like the Great Mystery and so on. Indian people often refer to the Creator. I think many Indian people today are probably fundamentally monotheistic. Big question, is that a Christian influence over the years, or isn't it? These are the kind of questions scholars struggle with. At the same time, Indian people do relate to spiritual powers everywhere in the world, all created things. I think one of the things you can say about American Indian religion is, in general, that's pretty valid across the board maybe, is there's a strong stress on the relationship between human beings and other living things or even the rest of creation. People can speak of our four-legged relatives or our flying relatives, and that kind of language illustrates that, I think. Mm-hmm. But it goes beyond just the kind of words. I mean, it's a sense of being one with all of creation and being part of it. You know, and does this mean that Indians are all wonderful environmentalists? No, of course not. Uh-huh. But it does mean that their religion gives them a boost in that direction, I think, because of the way they think of themselves in terms of the world.
We're talking today with Dr. Lawrence Martin, Professor Emeritus and Director Emeritus of the American Indian Studies Program at UW-Eau Claire. October 6th, you're going to be at the Chippewa Valley Museum, and that's part of the American Indian Heritage Community Day. Your topic is the Ojibwe language. Now, I'm sorry to say that I believe Americans know a lot more about German and Spanish and Latin and French than we do the language of the original Americans. And I don't want to give away your presentation on the 6th, but give us a little bit of a tease about what it is you're going to talk about, because I, for one, believe that maybe we should all know more about it.
Yeah. Well, partly I think I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to try to make people feel that they should know more about Ojibwe because even compared to many other native languages, Ojibwe around here is just extremely important. As you said, it's the language of the place. Historically, Ojibwe was incredibly important. There was a time, I forget who said this, one of the early writers, that you could travel from Montreal to Winnipeg and hundreds of miles north and south of there all along the way, And if you could speak Ojibwe, you could get along just fine. And that's not because that was all Ojibwe country. It's because Ojibwe was the language of the fur trade. So Ojibwe, historically, is an extremely important language. It's also an extremely interesting language. I mean, there's a kind of goofy thing in the Guinness Book of World Records that says Ojibwe is the world's most difficult language. I think that, who knows what's the most difficult. But it is very complex and intricate in terms of the grammatical system. And I'm certainly not going to try to bury people with that in 1 hour on October the 6th. Mm-hmm. But I do kind of want to give them a sense of how the language works, because languages determine the way we see the world. And because of the way the Ojibwe language works, I think Ojibwe people do have a certain way of seeing the world that in some ways is different. Just a quick illustration. And we talk about gender, and European languages, including English, have a masculine, feminine kind of gender. It works differently in Spanish than it works in English and so on. But it's characteristic of European languages in general. Ojibwe has gender too, but it's not male and female. It's animate and inanimate, living things and non-living things. So that, you know, for a pronoun, for example, you don't have a he, she pronoun. You have a ou or you, which means, you know, a living thing or a non-living thing. And it works throughout the language. I mean, it governs the verbs, it governs the nouns, everything. And you have to constantly be sort of adjusting to that, not consciously thinking of it, I suppose, a real speaker of Ojibwe doesn't consciously do this, but it's unconscious. But it illustrates that sense of being one with the rest of the living things on this planet, you know, because we're all animate.
For a while, anyway.
We're constantly reminded of that. So things like that I'll talk about a little bit, I think.
You don't appear to be a Native American to me. How did you learn the language? Although you did tell me that it is part of your makeup.
Yeah, my father was Ojibwe. I looked like my Norwegian mother who didn't speak any Ojibwe. My father didn't speak the language either, really, but he used occasional a few words here and there. My father had a cousin who was a Catholic nun who grew up on the reservation, and she was a native speaker, I think. Really was. And even from the time I was small, she always encouraged me to learn the language. And I didn't do too much about it until somewhat later, but that encouragement, I think, was a big factor.
Are there regional dialects of Ojibwe?
Oh, my, yes. There are definitely regional dialects. And sometimes they're pretty dramatically different. Other times it's relatively small stuff.
Well, it is fascinating.
Yeah. One more thing maybe we haven't talked about is the attempt that is going on in Ojibwe country to revive the language. I mean, there's a really serious kind of language revitalization program going on. There's at Lakota Ray now, for example, there's an immersion school for kids, which is everything is taught in Ojibwe except the one English class for the day, you know, 1 hour. So it's a very good thing that's happening. And it isn't only Ojibwe. I mean, native languages, because a lot of them are really in danger of dying. I'll teach people a few words because this is Ojibwe country. You know, people ought to know two or three words anyway.
Well, I want to start a trend here. I want everybody who is listening to Spectrum West to start saying a few things in Ojibwe. Like, for instance, how would we say hello?
Okay. There are basically two ways that are used.
Bonjour.
Which probably is one of the few French loan words that comes from the fur trade. It's probably bonjour, although people would argue that there are other explanations for that. But that's a common thing. And so people should really, you know, recognize that, bonjour. Other people say anin. Is another way of saying hello, yeah.
Okay.
And some people prefer one, some people the other, I think.
So all you Spectrum Westerners, bonjour or anin to people when you see them. And they, in turn, will say it to others, and we'll have people speaking Ojibwe. So then how do we say have a good day, for instance, when we leave that person?
You know, if you want to say it's a good day, you say minugijigad.
You better slow that down.
That's a bit of a bigger one. That's true. Like today, minugijigad nongomo mats. It's a beautiful day here today, you know. And how you'd say to a person you want them to have that is a little bit more complex. I think what you would simply probably just say that, and it would be understood that you're wishing it to the person, you know, minugijigad.
Say that slowly now.
Minugijigad.
Minugijigad.
Good. Minugijigad, yeah.
Okay. And finally, I think one that Captain Kangaroo would want us to all be aware of is thank you. How do you say thanks?
Oh, yeah, that's one probably a lot of people have heard. I mean, you hear it a lot. Miigwech. Miigwech.
Miigwech.
Miigwech. And you can intensify it by saying chi miigwech, which means thanks a lot. Or you can say miigwech ni bua is another way to say thanks a lot. But just miigwech, yeah.
Miigwech for being here. Man, that's fascinating stuff. Dr. Lawrence Larry Martin, Director Emeritus, American Indian Studies, UW-Eau Claire. The revitalization movement is good stuff, I think. I mean, we don't hesitate when a species becomes endangered, and the same can happen to a or the language of America's heritage. Remember, the day of observance is next Saturday, October 6th, at the Chippewa Valley Museum. Dr. Martin and several others doing demonstrations and additional talks. That, of course, the museum is in Eau Claire's Carson Park, and the day runs from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Hey, by the way, tomorrow the museum is open free of charge as part of the National Museum Day Live. That's pretty cool. We're rolling up towards 18 minutes before 6, 542 on Spectrum West.
Support for WPR comes from Visit Winona. Winona, the home of the Minnesota Marine Art Museum, featuring works by Homer, Monet, O'Keeffe, Picasso, and Van Gogh. Online at visitwinona.com, where arts, culture, and river beauty converge.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of Thoroughly Modern Millie will play next Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Northern Star Theater production of Get Smart opens next Thursday at the theater in Rice Lake. The show runs through October 14th. The Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Ramona Quimby opens next Friday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. Bingo the Musical, a production of the Menominee Theater Guild, will run next Friday through Sunday at the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. And the Bare Bones Ensemble Theater's monthly improv show will be presented at 8 p.m. Thursday at the Stone's Throw in downtown Eau Claire. The mystery comedy Glass of Denial plays tonight and Saturday at the St. Croix Art Barn in Osceola. Playing with Fire will run tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show will run through October 27th. Is He Dead? The Baron Spotlighter's first production of the new season will be presented tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Baron Area Community Center. Moonlight and Magnolias plays tonight and Saturday and will play Fridays and Saturdays through October 27th at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. Also in Hudson, The Movie Game plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts. Star Spangled Girl plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show will play weekends and selected weekdays through October 28th. The Old Gem Professional Acting Company's annual production of Johnny Appleseed will play through October 19th for students preschool through third grade at the Old Gem Theater in New Richmond. And the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will hold auditions for the musical White Christmas at 7 p.m. Monday and Tuesday at the Grand Little Theater in Eau Claire. And that's some of what's happening in local live theater. I'm Jim Oliver.
Here's one more thing that's kind of up that theatrical road. The end of the season cleaning and closing of the Red Barn Theater in Rice Lake takes place tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Extra cleaning supplies, brooms and rags would be helpful. Some food will be supplied. That's cool. A good opportunity to give back if you've enjoyed the Red Barn productions over the summer.
Lay down your weary tune, lay down. Lay down the songs you strum and rest yourself neath the strength of strings. No voice can hope to hum, struck by the sound before the sun.
One of the very nicest things about doing the program is the chance I have to meet some folks I might not otherwise run into. They're from Minneapolis, and they're different, which in this day and age of music is good. Too often unheard of course. They're called Leto and Wright. Steve Leto, John Wright. We took the right way in finding out more about the group, which makes its first appearance at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee next Saturday evening, the 6th at 7:30. First, as usual, a bit of history and how Wright met Leto. And the music began.
Sure. A number of years ago, I think it was 1989, I'll say I was 10 or 12 years old at the time, I was involved with a Latin jazz ensemble that did sort of fusion-y stuff, sort of Santana meets Chick Corea type stuff. Steve was in that same band, and that's where we met. Now, at the time, neither of us were actively engaged in doing any sort of folk rock or folk music interpretation yet. I had been a fan of that style of music. I had been listening to it for a number of years. Steve was aware of it, but he had never tried to actively engage himself in it. So as the years went on, we both sort of were involved in different projects. I gradually became more interested in interpreting folk music in the rock context. I was exposed to a band called Fairport Convention, an English band that essentially invented the style of taking folk music, tunes, jigs and reels, and sort of rearranging them with electric instruments. There are other bands that do it. It's not an uncommon thing to hear nowadays, but somebody had to do it first, and most of the history books point towards Fairport Convention. Well, I saw them open up for Throw Tull, I think, in 1987 or something like that, or 1988. Became an immediate fanatic. So I farmed some of that music over to Steve. As we sort of crossed paths over the years, I started making solo records, John Wright solo records. I've made a couple. These were all in the mid-90s, early 90s, and I was involving Steve Leto in those efforts. Steve started bringing his own ideas and things that he wanted to do into the operation, the first of which actually was a Nick Drake song. Nick Drake's a English singer-songwriter, sort of cult hero now. He's been deceased since, I think, 1972, but a really interesting English folky guy. He brought a couple of Nick Drake songs, and he says, well, let's reinterpret these. So he started bringing stuff in, and then it just came up with the idea, well, you know, it's the two of us now. Why don't we start a band? Reinterpret folk music to our version of it, to our brand of reinterpreting folk music, because we're very sympathetic to each other's interests. We have very common musical interests.
Give us an example of a well-known folk song that you have interpreted.
Well-known in the British Isles tradition would be a song called Four Drunken Maidens.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in passing, American audiences have heard this. Yeah, it's one of our hits.
Okay.
If you can call it that. And we actually took the melody from one folk song and applied it to the words for Four Drunken Maidens and sort of created our own version of it.
You guys are multi-instrumentalists as well. How many instruments travel with you?
Quite a few. The band plays in essentially two different formats. One where we bring a drummer and we're more of a rock band. When I say bring a drummer, I mean our drummer of 12 years now. His name is Matt Jacobs. The other version of the band is where we function as a duo. And it's just Steve and myself. So if it's a duo, Steve will bring two or three acoustic guitars and a mandolin, and I will bring a bass guitar and an acoustic guitar. And I also play what's called bass pedals, which is something that the audience, kind of hidden from the audience, but it's essentially a small keyboard at my feet that I can play bass notes on.
Oh, cool.
For some added low end. When we bring the drummer, Matthew, along with us, we will haul electric guitars as well. And that's what we're bringing to the Mabel Tainter. We're bringing the full band, electric guitars. It's kind of funny. We'll go to folk festivals. We have over the years, and we waltz up with our stuff. Cause by nature of the beast, you're going to have equipment, heavy, heavy things, amplifiers and things like this.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons that people love to do solos, because it's so easy.
I've never done a solo gig in my life. I'm very, I'm trying to think of the right word. I'm always amazed at somebody that can do that, you know, that can stand up with just a guitar and hold a crowd. That's quite a talent to have.
When you were searching for a word, I was going to say greedy, because I did talk to I did talk to a guy once who said, well, that's the reason I do a solo, because I get to keep all the money.
Well, that's one reason. Yeah, that's good. Fewer mouths to feed, less overhead. That's all part of the deal.
That's true. Our guest is John Wright. He is half of Leto and Wright, be a third for the band that's coming to the Mabel Tainter on October 6th. Matt Jacobs is the drummer. You guys really, from what I've seen and heard, you really seem to enjoy playing a lot. And many of your songs are kind of extended versions, and I was wondering if that's always choreographed, or do you guys simply get into jamming that just won't stop because you're having so much fun?
Well, we do have fun, so thank you for the observation. Most of what we do is highly choreographed, meaning the arrangements are set in place.
Okay.
There is some improvisation that's involved with some of the pieces, open-ended or extended solos, which allow the band to have some free form. But a lot of what we do is highly arranged and highly rehearsed, constructed, that we've organized and sort of worked out over the years. It's good to be able to exercise that part of the brain. It's good to be able to have both. Part of our influences come from a tradition of progressive rock in the 70s. It wasn't uncommon for a band to have a 20-minute piece of music.
Yeah.
It wasn't uncommon to see a quote-unquote pop artist release an album that had extended tracks. So that's kind of where we're coming from with the longer pieces of music.
Guys in radio years ago used to love those because they could go do something.
Yeah, they called it bathroom music.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I wasn't going to, but you're right. That's exactly what we did. If there's a way to pigeonhole it, what are people in for when they come to a Lato and Wright show?
Well, the common terminology that's used is Celtic American folk and folk rock.
Boy, that's hard to imagine. As soon as you inject the word Celtic, maybe that one shouldn't be first, or should it be first?
Well, what we've discovered, because the business requires us to pigeonhole it.
Okay.
In order to get a gig. Essentially, you have to tell people what it is you do, and you have to be quick about it.
So Celtic is the source of your material?
Some of it, yeah. And Celtic is a big word. Celtic is, nowadays, anything British Isles, which Ireland, England, Scotland, traditional French stuff. So anything drawn from their folk music history. But the difference with Lato and Wright is we wanted to do that same thing, only we wanted to do it with American folk music as well, okay? And that was part of our mission statement when we actually started the band. We're going to do rocked-up versions of American folk music. We'll take a Pete Seeger song, for example, and rearrange it and amplify it, or simply rearrange it. One of our albums is called The Further Adventures of Darlene Corey. Darlene Corey is an American traditional song, and we reinterpreted that, wrote some extra music for it, and played it on electric guitars. So it's the same thing that the British guys are doing with their folk music we wanted to do with the American. So hopefully that moniker covers everything, Celtic American folk.
Yeah, the only reason I was concerned about the word Celtic is I think it has acquired kind of a Irish Lord of the Dance type feel to it over the last few years, and that, from what I've heard and seen you guys do, isn't you. You do some pretty neat stuff. What you've accomplished, obviously, is you're unique. You've got a niche, as they say.
Well, thank you. That can work for you or against you.
How's it working for you?
It's working fine.
And also, I believe that you and I, if nothing else, have succeeded in causing people to say, I've got to go see those guys because this chat didn't tell me exactly what they are. So, and that's good. And you said that the industry makes you define who you are and what you do, but I'm kind of happy to hear that you can't. And that's got to feel good, too, because it makes it feel like you've got this wide-open genre within which you can roll around.
Correct. For example, we could have called the band The Green Trees, or some other moniker that would force some sort of flavor on the list. So if you go to somebody and say, well, I have this new band, they're called Green Trees, I think they're great, you're automatically going to think something, then, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to, I have this new band called Metallica, you're going to think something about that. Lato and Wright doesn't tell you a lot on purpose. You kind of have to actually listen.
Yeah. Oh, darn, huh?
To understand it.
Yeah, and kudos to Matt Jacobs, too, because he has no ego. He hasn't approached you and said, you know, come on, guys,
You hit it on the nail head, and you actually, without having met him, Matt is I should say something about him. He's an amazing drummer, percussionist. We essentially throw these arrangements at him, and he just sort of absorbs them and does them perfectly.
Shendo. I long to hear you. Away, rolling river. Shenandoah, I long to hear you. Away, I'm bound to. Shenandoah.
One critical media quote reads, "Wonderfully intricate, powerful, guitar-driven music." And that should be enough for many purists who simply enjoy to watch people make great music. Lato and Wright, next Saturday evening at the marvelous Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. You can check them out at latoandwright.com. That's L-E-H-T-O and Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. That's good stuff. Wow. Well, we're getting up towards the end of another Spectrum West for the 28th day of September. Congratulations, by the way, to the UW River Falls Journalism Department celebrating 50 years tomorrow with an open house on the third floor of North Hall from 10 to 2. That includes the facilities of our strong WPR and Spectrum West affiliate, WRFW 88.7. There's also a reception and banquet later in the day at Kilcarney Hills Golf Course. Way to go, Falcons. Let's see, next Wednesday evening at UWRF, the first Wyman Series event welcomes Zach Walls and a presentation called What Makes a Family. He's the son of two lesbian mothers and author of a book on the subject. It's 7:30 p.m., the Riverview Ballroom of the University Center. At the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, the Jail Bailers perform next Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. Then Peter Yarrow, of course, plays and sings a week from tonight, 7:30, and Beatles tribute band The Britons perform the next night, Saturday, October 6th at 7:30. In the gallery, a brother-sister exhibit called Sibling Rivalry, the works of Rodney Kajewski and Gene Arneson. A reception is next Friday at 5 p.m. All Heidi information is at cvca.net. Thanks, as always, to Jim Oliver for his contributions and to Hannah Lagerman for promotional assistance. Next week, we've got a lot planned, believe me. I don't have time to tell you. What's going on this weekend? Funny you should ask. Mary Mack, fellow comedian Tim Harmston, are getting married tomorrow. Ever been to a funny wedding? I'm going. Hey, by the way, G. McGuach for listening to Spectrum West, everybody. Have a good weekend.